Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Let's see, Representative Detmer, would you like to move the minutes from our previous meeting?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes for April 10th, 2015.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Detmer. Any questions or comments on the minutes? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes of April 10th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Detmer. Committee members, as you know, today we're going to do a walkthrough on the delete all amendment to House Bill 44, so our omnibus bill. And I think what we'll do is go ahead and devote our time starting with a walkthrough of the provisions of the bill. All of you should have in your packets the delete all amendment, the actual language, as well as the House research bill summary, tracking sheet, and district runs. And so I think we'll go ahead and go through the provisions of the bill first, and then we'll do the tracking sheet afterwards. I think if members just want to, again, if you've got a question about something as we're going through, just, you know, raise your hand and we'll try to address the questions as they come up. And with that, I have to start by giving a big thank you to all of the staff, and the nonpartisan staff in particular have spent many hours. I was here a while, and they were here a lot longer working on putting this together. So to Ms. Larson, Ms. Johnson, and Mr. Strom, a huge thank you, as well as to my staff, to Jody Withers, to Mr. Withers, and Gabrielle Haughey, our researcher, and to Ms. Keynes, who my schedule would be a complete mess without you. So thank you to all of the staff, but also to the D of L staff as well. I know we've got a lot of work to do here over the next week, so I just wanted to open by saying thank you so much to the many, many hours that you've put on and into this already, and how many hours yet to come. So it is truly appreciated, but by myself, and I know all of the other committee members as well. So with that, Mr. Strom, are you leading off?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, in your packet, as the chair said, you'll find the delete all amendment labeled A15-0458. Ms. Larson and I will be going through the bill, and then Ms. Johnson will walk you through the spreadsheets. I'll try to group things a little bit together and make it a fairly quick trip through, spending a little more time perhaps on some of the things that are a little different. First provision, Section 1, Article 1, is one of several provisions related to the Flexible Learning Year Program. These were provisions from House File 1591 that allow the school board, instead of the Commissioner of Education, to set the length of a school year for the Flexible Learning Year Program. Section 2 relates to general education revenue for charter schools. The change here is found on page 2, starting in paragraph B on line 3. And what this change does is creates a category of extended day, extended time, and extended week revenue for charter schools equal to 25% of the statewide average revenue for extended time revenue. The statewide average around $72 or so currently. The name of the program was changed as part of House File 1591 from extended time to extended support revenue. But this change, as I said, relates to the charter schools. The next five sections all have to do with the learning year programs, and again are converting the program from one requiring approval by the Commissioner of Education to a program that allows the school board to approve the four-day calendar. Madam Chair, members, then the next provision that brings us to on page 3 is Section 8. This is the definition of general education revenue. Obsolete language is removed in the first paragraph, and in the second paragraph, the name extended time revenue is changed to extended support revenue. Section 9 on the next page is the basic formula allowance. The amendment in front of you increases the revenue by $33 the first year, and a total of $67 the second year, so a $33 increase the first year, another $34 on top of that for $67 during the second year. Section 10 on page 4 increases the extended time revenue for school districts. Currently, that keys off a formula allowance of $5,017. This increases that by $146 for the extended time program. The next provision, Section 11, at the bottom of the page, has to do with the aid levy split. It's not a revenue provision, but it changes the aid and levy for districts that receive local optional revenue. For those districts where more than 30% of the district's tax base is cabins or seasonal rec property, a special factor is put into the equalizing factor to enhance the equalization for those districts. As I mentioned, this is an aid levy change, not a change in revenue to districts. Section 12 has to do with compensatory revenue. Under current law, compensatory revenue is computed on a concentration basis. It's the count of free and reduced price meal eligible students multiplied by a concentration factor that results in each site's compensatory revenue. The change in Section 12 essentially keeps the current revenue, the current concentration in revenue in place for the formula allowance of $5,831, and then starting on line 5.15, adds the amount of compensatory revenue that would have been received had the compensatory gone up with the formula allowance into a separate portion of compensatory that's not weighted by concentration, but rather is simply the count of the free and reduced lunch students. It's the free plus one-half the reduced times the amount in that increase that would have occurred had it still been linked to the formula allowance. Given the size of the formula allowance increase in the House bill, is about a $3.5 million distribution the first year and about $7 million the second year. And as I said, that additional compensatory money goes out on the basis of the free plus one-half the reduced price meal count. Section 13 is just a technical correction. Section 14 is a provision similar to House File 1396, Representative Purcell's Transportation Sparsity Bill. This provision provides additional transportation sparsity revenue to school districts in either one of two categories. Either the school district is larger than 3,000 square miles, which is the St. Louis County School District, or the school district is larger than a square mile area of 525 miles and is not eligible for sparsity revenue. And so it's if the school district meets either of those criteria, their transportation sparsity revenue is increased under this provision. Section 15 is the equity change. This is a provision that a couple of members had bills on. On line 7.19, you can see that the what's often referred to as the Metro equity bump, the 25% increase in equity revenue for the Metro school districts, is applied to all school districts in the state beginning in fiscal year 2017. Section 16 is paired with a few of the repealers. This on lines 8.4 and 8.5, you can see that the student achievement levy is being eliminated. And then on line 8.6, an oversight from last year's bill, operating capital aid, just needed to be added back in. That's a technical change from last year. But the student achievement levy is being stricken on lines 8.4 and 8.5 from the general education aid calculation. And as I said in the repealer, there's a couple of subdivisions being repealed to accomplish that as well. Sections 17 and 18 have to do with the compensatory revenue calculation. A couple of changes worth highlighting in the use of compensatory revenue, starting at the bottom of page 8 and at the top of page 9. There are some additional uses for compensatory revenue, including for recruitment and new teacher development activities, as well as certain activities for effective or highly effective teacher under the review cycle. Those are coupled with changes if those teachers are willing to work in a hard-to-fill position by subject area or a hard-to-staff school setting, allows the compensatory revenue to be used for those purposes as well. On page 9, line 21, this is clarification that compensatory revenue can be used for early education programs, including four-year-old and pre-kindergarten programs. In section 18, the compensatory revenue under current law must be allocated to each site with some certain exceptions. Essentially, 90% needs to go to the site currently. Under the language in the bill, the school board would be responsible for determining how to allocate compensatory revenue among the sites in the school district. Section 19.
Representative Murphy.
Could you do that one more time,
sure,
please, and a little slower?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, my apologies. In Section 18, the allocation for compensatory revenue is changed. Under current law, at least 90% of the revenue needs to go to the school site where that revenue is generated. Under the change, the school board, this is change is found on starting on line 10.4, the school board essentially is given authority to determine how to reallocate any of that compensatory revenue. So it's changing it from a statutory limit to a school board-driven decision.
Representative Murphy.
Is that for the total amount of compensatory aid they get?
Madam
the
Chair.
The school district gets?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, yes. Madam Chair, members, section 19 on the bottom of page 10 clarifies that now that the school board is making the allocation decision, that the recommendations of each school site are advisory to the school board on how the compensatory revenue should be spent at each site. Madam Chair, members, starting on page 11 and going through the bottom of page 12 are some changes from House File 1591 to clarify how the referendum is calculated. These changes have to do with the interrelationship between local optional revenue and the referendum, and in my view, these are technical to make those calculations work a bit easier. There's no change in the amount that any district would receive under those. Madam Chair, members, Ms. Johnson, when she walks through the spreadsheet, will talk about the appropriations in Article 1. And lastly, on page 15 at the top are the provisions being repealed in Article 1, the 126C13 provisions. Those are the ones, Madam Chair, relating to the repeal of the student achievement levy. And then the others are listed in the bill summary. 126C12 subdivision 6 is from House File 1591 and has to do with the annual report on expenditures of learning and development revenue. Section 126C41 is an obsolete provision that granted school districts levy authority for certain employees for their health insurance costs for those employees who retired during 1992. And finally, Madam Chair, the rule repeal of Part 3500-1000 is related to the flexible school year or learning year programs that were discussed earlier in this article.
Any other questions on those sections? Okay, I think we'll move on to the next. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, members, Article 2 of the A15-04 5A document contains many provisions that you've seen before, either from House File 1591 and or House File 2. There are also a number of other provisions, but the majority of these sections do in fact come from one or both of those documents. Sections 1 and 2 come from a bill that Representative Seltzer offered affecting students in Minnesota who travel abroad. The districts and charter schools with students who do travel abroad are required to annually report to the department on student deaths and students hospitalized while they were participating in the program. There's a direction to the education department to aggregate and post the data. There is encouragement to the districts and schools to adopt program policies and standards for these students. There is a requirement that the travel abroad program providers annually register with the Minnesota Secretary of State and provide specific information about the program to the Secretary of State. Section 2, which is also part of the Seltzer bill, would prohibit schools from disclosing directory information to a travel abroad program provider unless that provider is registered with the Secretary of State's office. Sections 3 and 4 amend language from a provision that Representative Norton authored last year. It establishes voluntary bilingual and multilingual seals that would recognize high school students' proficiency in another language other than English according to standards established by the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. In addition to a number of other provisions that amend the law from 2014, there is a direction to MNSCU institutions to award college credits to students who demonstrate proficiency in grade 10, 11, or 12 sufficient to earn the seals. Section 5 is a local literacy plan. It was both in House File 1591 and introduced by Representative Runbreck. It requires local literacy plans to describe a number of factors, data on assessment effectiveness, parent involvement, intervention strategies, progress monitoring, and staff development. Section 6, which is one of many 1591 provisions, directs the Education Commissioner to disaggregate data on these kinds of rigorous programs and to also include information on career and technical education courses offered as part of concurrent enrollment. There is additional number of additional reporting requirements. These are from a bill that Representative Dabney introduced, and I see here in the cold light of day that the bill summary needs to be corrected because there were originally references to highly mobile students, and that proved problematic in terms of the definition as well as monitoring. So sections 7, 8, and 9 come from both House File 1219 and House File 1591. It's a requirement for reporting data on student homelessness in various iterations where the data is made public. Section 10 is again part of House File 1591 and also was included in House File 2. It directs the Board of Teaching to allow teacher licensure candidates to submit essentially equivalent ACT or SAT passing scores in lieu of the college level skills exam. There is a direction to the Board of Teaching to adopt rules to license out-of-state teacher candidates. Section 11 is an amalgam of two bills that Representatives Erickson and Erdahl introduced on teacher and school administrator data, House Files 642 and 244. The language directs the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators in cooperation with MACD and board-approved teacher preparation programs to collect and report summary data on teacher and school administrator preparation and performance outcomes. There are data collection requirements on teachers, on school administrators, on teachers who finish their probationary periods and accepted a continuing contract, on probationary teachers who were released or whose contracts were not renewed during their probationary period, on school principals who finished their probationary period and accepted a continuing contract, and on principals who were released or whose contracts were not renewed during the probationary period. Section 12 directs the Board of Teaching to publish on its website summary data on teacher preparation program outcomes. There is language in Section 13, which originally came from a bill that Representative Erickson introduced, to make retired school principals who serve as short calls substitute principals subject to continuing education requirements. Consistent with the earlier requirements to publish data on school principals, this directs the Board of School Administrators to publish cumulative summary data on principal preparation program outcomes. Section 15 requires the Board of Teaching to license qualified out-of-state teacher candidates, to allow licensure candidates to submit essentially equivalent ACT or SAT passing scores instead of the college level skills exam. And also, and this was not in House File 1591, at the request of a district or charter school, the Board of Teaching is required to issue an additional temporary one-year teaching license to a teacher who is employed by that district or charter school who held a temporary one-year license in the previous school year. Section 16 directs the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators to automatically revoke an individual's teaching license after receiving a certified copy of a conviction that shows the individual was convicted of child abuse, including child sexual abuse. Section 17 requires the Board of Teaching to notify candidates who submit a portfolio for teacher licensure whether or not that portfolio was approved, and also how to revise a portfolio in order to successfully demonstrate the requisite competence. Section 18 directs the Board of Teaching to establish criteria and procedures to recognize the experience and credentials of an out-of-state applicant for a Minnesota teaching license. It directs the Board of Teaching to issue a teaching license to an out-of-state applicant who meets certain criteria. There is also a direction to the board to issue up to 3 temporary one-year teaching licenses to an out-of-state applicant who meets certain criteria under some circumstances. In addition, there is a direction to the Board of Teaching to enter into interstate agreements for teacher licensure that would allow fully certified teachers from adjoining states to transfer their certification to Minnesota and receive a Minnesota teaching license. And finally, there is encouragement to the Board of Teaching to work with adjoining states to establish reciprocal teacher licensure agreements. Section 19 allows a nonprofit corporation that is organized for an education-related purpose that either partners with a college or university with a board-approved teacher preparation program or consults with such an entity to provide teacher preparation programs that allow candidates to acquire a limited-term license in preparing for a standard license. There is a requirement consistent with this section that a person with a limited license must take and pass either the college-level skills exam or demonstrate attainment of ACT or SAT passing scores. Section 20 requires the BOT, the Board of Teaching, to permit teacher candidates to demonstrate their preparation through non-traditional means. Section 21 directs the Board of Teaching to issue a Minnesota teaching license to a qualified candidate who has become qualified through an alternative preparation path. Section 22 has to do with non-licensed community experts. It allows school districts and charter schools without need for Board of Teaching approval to hire non-licensed community experts after trying to obtain acceptable licensed teachers for a particular course or subject area. Section 23, with the approval of a local employing school board, proposes to exempt a part-time vocational or career and technical education program teacher from teacher licensure requirements. Section 24, and this is all what follows is all part of House File 2, allows a local school board to negotiate an unrequested leave of absence plan for probationary teachers. Section 25 prohibits school administrators from placing placing students in consecutive school years in the classroom of a teacher who receives a low evaluation in the previous school year unless there are no other teachers available. Section 26 requires the school board and its bargaining unit to negotiate an unrequested leave of absence plan. Beginning in the 2017-2018 school year, school boards must place teachers on unrequested leave of absence based on their licensure field, evaluation outcomes and effectiveness category or rating, and other locally determined criteria such as teacher seniority. It also establishes a hearing process to determine whether the teacher evaluation requirements were met. Finally, that section prohibits using evaluation outcomes and effectiveness categories to place a teacher on unrequested leave of absence if the principal who is evaluating the teacher is himself or herself on an improvement plan. Section 27 which is part of House File 2, applies to provisions that are effective through the 2016-2017 school year only. So this is what remains in effect until the proposed changes in House File 2 go into effect. Section 28 requires the school board to immediately discharge a continuing contract teacher whose license has been revoked due to conviction for child abuse, including child sexual abuse. Section 29 allows a board to negotiate a plan for discontinuing or terminating probationary teachers as an alternative to the probationary teacher's current at-will employment status. Section 30 prohibits school administrators, and this is a provision you saw earlier, but in this case applies to first-class city school districts, from placing students in consecutive school years in the classroom of a teacher with the lowest evaluation rating in the previous school year unless no other teacher is available. Section 31 directs a school board in a first-class city school district to immediately discharge a teacher whose license has been revoked due to a conviction for child abuse, including child sexual abuse. Section 32, again from House File 2, establishes the procedures beginning in 2017-2018 for discontinuing and terminating teachers based on their licensure field, evaluation outcomes, and effectiveness category or rating, and other locally determined criteria such as seniority. Again, this also establishes a hearing process to determine whether the teacher evaluation requirements were met. Through the 16-17 school year, teachers holding a provisional educational license are allowed to exercise their seniority. Finally, in that provision, there is a prohibition against using evaluation outcomes and effectiveness categories to place a teacher on unrequested leave of absence if the principal who evaluates the teacher is on an improvement plan. Section 33 has to do with what is often referred to as QComp. Adds permissive language that would allow such a system to include a hiring bonus or other compensation for effective or highly effective teachers who would elect to work in a hard-to-fill position or a hard-to-staff school. It would allow incentives for teachers to obtain a master's degree or pursue additional licensure or help fund a Grow Your Own Teacher initiative, and also provides for teacher-powered site-governed schools, which are named specifically in a subsequent section in this article. Section 34, having to do with staff development, requires school boards to use staff development revenue for both teacher and principal development and evaluation plans, in-service education programs, and other staff development needs. Section 35 requires school districts to reserve at least 2% of basic revenue for teacher and principal professional development and evaluation, and also for in-service education programs. Section 36 requires student teachers to be placed with a cooperating licensed teacher who has at least 3 years of teaching experience and is not involved in an improvement plan. Section 37 on teacher mentorship allows school districts to develop and implement mentoring programs. It requires such programs to support districts' teacher development and evaluation and peer review processes. Section 38 on teacher assignment for purposes of district consolidation, and again, this was a provision in House File 2, assigns the most effective teacher with the greatest seniority to the district receiving the most students and lays out the plan going forward for the remaining students. Section 39 amends existing law by indicating that district-created site-governed schools are also teacher-powered schools. Sections 40, 41, 42, 43 have to do with concurrent enrollment and PSEO, actually as do 44 and 45. 40 would allow 9th and 10th grade students to enroll in concurrent enrollment course subject to agreement between a district and a post-secondary institution, also to enroll in a world languages course that is available to 11th and 12th grade students. Section 41 allows a student in grade 10 who did not take the MCA reading test in grade 8 to substitute another assessment accepted by MNSCU for purposes of enrolling in a career and technical education course under PSEO. Section 42 removes the limits on PSEO participation for students who are not on track to graduate. Section 43 strikes language that restricts a post-secondary institution from advertising the educational, programmatic, and financial benefits of PSEO courses. It also prohibits post-secondary institutions from enrolling secondary pupils under PSEO that are not college level, except when a student is in a graduation incentives program and enrolls full-time in a middle or early college program. This is a section that becomes effective immediately. Section 44 requires all MNSCU institutions to give full credit to a student enrolling in a MNSCU institution who, as a high school PSEO student, completed PSEO course or program for post-secondary credit, and requires that once one MNSCU institution certifies the student's course or program, that all MNSCU institutions must do so. Section 45 directs post-secondary institutions providing concurrent enrollment courses to implement national program standards. Then sections 46 through 58 were included in House File 1591 as introduced and proposed by the department. These sections address a variety of matters relating to educating American Indian students. Among other things, they address shared time enrollment, extracurricular activities, certain kinds of licenses, affirmative efforts in hiring, community coordinators, community participation and involvement, technical assistance, and the duties of a American Indian Education Director to serve as a liaison. Sections 59 and 60 have to do with achievement and integration for Minnesota. This proposal establishes the Achievement and Integration for Minnesota program as a program to improve academic achievement and promote racial and economic integration and create equitable educational opportunities and outcomes. There is a definition of hard-to-staff classroom or school, a requirement that eligible districts use their achievement gap elimination aid to improve all students' academic achievement and to eliminate disparities among categories of students. This provision allows eligible students to use the integration levy to promote racial and economic integration and to use the integration aid and levy to promote, to recruit and retain a diverse core of administrators and teachers and to provide incentives for teachers to teach in hard-to-staff classrooms and schools. It also allows cash incentives to be paid. The school boards under this provision are required to develop and implement a comprehensive plan, cost-effective interventions, and are allowed to collaborate in creating efficiency and eliminating duplicative programs and services. There is a requirement that districts hold a meeting to publicly report progress on realizing their achievement goals, a direction to districts to submit a budget to the commissioner, and a requirement that data be used to measure district and district progress by using data such as student growth and progress in reading and math, student performance data and achievement reports, and high school reading and math test outcomes. Subdivision 5 of that particular section directs the Education Commissioner to evaluate the efficacy of the plans in eliminating disparities and in realizing economic and racial integration. And Madam Chair, here's another on Section 60 in the bill summary. There's a mistake in the sense that this is old language from the House File 1591 bill summary, and I apologize. So hopefully by the next iteration of this bill summary, it will be corrected. Section 60 establishes a formula for calculating initial the initial achievement gap elimination revenue. It makes districts eligible for such revenue under such circumstances. It provides for achievement gap elimination aid and integration levy. It describes the uses of the revenue for academic programs and other programs providing direct instructional services. It provides for reserving the revenue for specified programs. And it allocates 0.2% of the total expenditures to the department for oversight and accountability purposes. Section 1 requires MNSCU institutions to give full credit to PSEO students who complete a post-secondary course or program for post-secondary credit. Section 62, beginning in the 2017-2018 school year, prohibits the school board and the teachers from executing an employment contract unless it contains an unrequested leave of absence plan or a plan for discontinuing or terminating teachers. Section 63 makes the sites of a charter school not receiving QCOMP funding eligible for fiscal year 2015 teacher development and evaluation revenue. Section 64 directs the Board of Teaching to report to the legislature on the number of agreements granting full licensure to qualified out-of-state teaching candidates. Section 65 directs the MNSCU Chancellor to report to the legislature on implementing the transfer curriculum policy for PSEO students and also how to standardize such things as AP, IB, and CLEP course equivalencies across all of the system facilities. Section 66 contains the appropriations that Ms. Johnson will review, and Section 67 repeals the statutory unrequested leave of absence plan for teachers generally consistent with the proposals in House File 2. And that, Madam Chair, is Article 2.
I'm not seeing any questions right now on Section 2, so I think we'll move on to 3.
Madam Chair, members, Article 3 of A15-0458 contains the substance of House File 1591 and a testing bill that Representative Bennett introduced and a number of provisions proposed by the department. Section 1 on graduation requirements requires high school students enrolled in grade 8 in the 2014-2015 school year to take state-developed reading, writing, and math tests instead of a nationally normed college entrance exam in order to graduate from high school. Section 2 postpones until 2020-2021 the revision of the state math standards. Section 3 directs districts to use the world language standards that were developed by the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. Section 4 allows an agriculture science or career and technical education credit to fulfill an elective science credit or a chemistry or physics credit if certain requirements are met. It also allows a computer science credit to fulfill a math credit. Section 5 on performance measures includes students' performance on the high school reading, writing, and math MCAs as a measure of indicating post-secondary readiness for the world's best workforce. Section 6, consistent with a repealer at the end of this article, strikes a cross-reference to the EPAS program offered by the ACT. Section 7 essentially contains, in part, a description of the transition that is required in terms of statewide tests required for graduation. It allows students enrolled in grade 8 through the 2009-10 school year and in students who were enrolled in grade 8 in the 2010-2011 or 2011-2012 school year to take the high school MCAs as an alternative assessment in order to graduate from high school. Section strikes language directing the Education Commissioner to contract for a series of assessments that include college and career readiness benchmarks or that the assessments be predictive of a nationally normed assessment for college and career readiness. There is language here that was not in Representative Bennett's bill specifically that requires a district to pay one time the cost for an interested student in grade 11 or 12 who is eligible for a meal benefit to take a nationally recognized college entrance exam. That section also strikes language requiring districts and schools annually to use the career exploration elements in the statewide assessments to help students and their families explore and plan for post-secondary education or careers. It strikes language as requiring a college placement diagnostic exam. It strikes language directing the education commissioner to determine the alignment between the previously proposed assessments and state academic standards. Paragraph J of that section directs the education commissioner, in consultation with the Minsky chancellor, to identify minimum score guidelines on the high school MCAs in order to determine what is a demonstration of readiness either for certificates or a two-year or four-year college program. The following paragraphs, M, N, and O, require the education commissioner to annually administer computer adaptive reading and math assessments aligned with state academic standards to all students in grades 3 through 8. Section 8 makes conforming changes consistent with other sections in this article. Section 9 has appropriations that Ms. Johnson will explain, and Section 10 contains a repealer of the EPAS program offered by the ACT. And Madam Chair, that's Article 3.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Larson, could you go back and tell us where that math standards were and what we did, or what is being proposed?
Ms. Larson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it's Article 2, it's Article 3, Section 2, I think. And what is being proposed here is to postpone what is currently scheduled to be a review and revision of the state math standards in 2015-2016 until the 2020-2021 school year. There is a statutorily established cycle for reviewing and revising state standards in various core academic areas. And what this proposes to do is to postpone until 2020-2021 the scheduled revision of the state math standards.
And then,
Representative Murphy.
Chair, Ms. Larson, were we, in Article 3, were we eliminating any tests?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, in 2013, the legislature enacted legislation to establish a suite of assessments with a number of different components to it. The proposal was in part anticipated the ability to possibly use the ACT suite of assessments in order to effect the changes, so that there would be diagnostic and predictive characteristics in the suite of assessments. It turns out that the suite with respect to the ACT is not going to be available. And because it is not available, it was on that basis that both the department as well as Representative Bennett proposed to make some changes in order to anticipate the unavailability of that particular suite of assessments.
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Larson, can you refresh my memory on why the ACT tests weren't going to be available?
Representative Murphy, I think, or these are the plan and the explore test. So it's not the ACT plus writing, which many of us are familiar with for college entrance. These are the ones for 8th grade and 10th grade that were given. And it's my understanding, and correct me, Ms. Larson, if I'm incorrect, but that those two tests are going away. ACT is no longer offering those tests. They're revising and offering a different product. Aspire, I think, maybe is the name. So this language reflects that those tests are going away, so we're eliminating the mandate of offering those tests.
In the 8th and 10th grade.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And
I don't think that was in my memory.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, so shall we just pick up where we left off? Any other questions right now? Okay, go ahead, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, on the A15-0458 document, Article 4 on Charter Schools, a number of the provisions are from House File 1591, but not all of them. Section 1, for example, was not in House File 1591. It requires a district that provides public pupil transportation services on behalf of a charter school to allow a non-resident pupil attending the charter school to ride the bus on district bus routes. Section 1591 included a number of provisions proposed by the reviser of statutes. There was a direction previously requesting that the sections on charter schools be recodified. So there are a number of technical provisions throughout this article reflecting changes that the reviser is proposing to make in anticipation of that recodification. So Section 2 is one of those examples. It has technical impact. Section 3 is partly technical and partly substantive. Paragraph G in Section 3 allows an authorizer or requires an authorizer that intends to withdraw to provide notice of its intent according to a timeline, and that would apply regardless of when the authorizer's five-year term of approval ends. Section 4 is another of those reviser proposed changes. It's technical in part. Paragraph G requires an authorizer to file an affidavit to charter a new charter school at least 14 months before July 1 of the year in which the new charter school plans to begin to serve students. And this is at the request of the department in terms of a clarification, prevents the hours a student is enrolled in a fee-based kindergarten program from generating pupil units or being used to calculate general education revenue. Section 5, in part, contains technical changes proposed by the reviser. It also allows a charter school to offer a fee-based preschool or pre-kindergarten program. It prohibits a charter school from charging tuition except for fee-based preschool or pre-kindergarten programs. And it would allow charter schools that enroll where at least 90% of the students enrolled are deaf or hard of hearing to also enroll pre-kindergarten students with a disability. Section 6 allows a charter school that offers a free preschool or pre-K program to give enrollment preference to the children enrolled in that program who are eligible in the next year to enroll in kindergarten. Section 7 of that article requires a charter school to comply with the statutory section that governs the approval and payment of special education programs and costs, and it would require charter schools that enroll deaf and hard of hearing children in a pre-K program to comply with interagency early childhood intervention system requirements. Section 8 allows a charter school to combine its annual reports. Section 9 is consistent with Section 1. It requires a school district to provide transportation to non-resident charter school pupils attending a charter school within the district boundaries. Section 10 allows a charter school authorizer to terminate an existing charter school contract if in the previous three consecutive school years the performance of that charter school based on both federal and state education accountability measures would place the school in the bottom 10% of all public schools as determined by the education commissioner. Section 11 describes a process to allow charter schools to merge and establishes requirements for that merger. Sections 12 and 13 are technical, and Section 14 contains an appropriation section that Ms. Johnson will review.
All right, we'll move on to Article 5.
Madam Chair, members, Article 5 is the special education article that starts on page 120 of the bill and page 24 of the bill's summary. Number of criteria or requirements from House File 1591, and I'll rather quickly go through the bill summary. Many of the provisions in this article relate to the straightening out the roles between the resource centers and the Department of Education for providing services to the deaf and hard of hearing community. The Section 1 essentially replaces the director of the resource center with a state specialist at the department with responsibility for providing certain duties. Section 2 does relatively the same thing for oral or acute speech transliterators. Section 3 is clarification language related to the responsibilities for providing pupil transportation to children with a disability who are not yet enrolled in kindergarten. Section 4 is a provision that's slightly altered since this committee saw it last. This has to do with the definition of dyslexia. Dyslexia is defined in this statute, and the new language is the last sentence added to the bill, which requires students who have a diagnosis of dyslexia to also meet state and federal eligibility criteria in order to qualify for special education services. So meeting the definition alone of dyslexia would not change a student's qualification for special education services in Minnesota. Section 5 includes for the interagency intervention service system, essentially makes the school board or the county board instead of the interagency early intervention committee the one responsible for providing certain services. Section 6, Madam Chair, directs the state interagency committee to consult with the special ed advisory panel and the governor's interagency coordinating commission instead of the interagency early intervention committee. Section 7 has a lot of new language in it, but much of it is essentially stricken language from elsewhere in that section. It's reorganizing the statute that's outlining the local agency coordination responsibilities. It also reassigns the responsibilities and duties of the interagency early intervention committee to the member school boards and county boards that are working on that process. And again, these provisions are from House File 1591. Section 7, Madam Chair, Section 8, Ms. Larson may want to speak to the origins of Section 8, but essentially a provision that has to do with the training that paraprofessionals who work with students with disabilities need to have. I don't remember offhand the bill that came from.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, that was a bill that Representative Christensen introduced and was discussed in the Education Innovation Policy Committee.
Madam Chair, members, then there's a couple of sections in the starting with Section 9 in this article that have to do with the online management system for special education records. The 2013 and 2014 legislatures made some changes to set up essentially a statewide record-keeping system for special education purposes. The changes here are essentially instead of requiring school districts to use the state mandated system, require the school districts to use a system that meets certain specifications and to contract with a vendor who meets the state specifications, but essentially allows school districts greater flexibility when it comes to the state student information systems for the online special education reporting. Section 11, Madam Chair, has to do with the physical holding and seclusion statute. The change in this provision this year makes permissive rather than mandatory that the stakeholders recommend annual implementation and outcome goals to the Education Commissioner. Section 12 has to do with third-party payments. Third-party payments occur when special education services also cover certain health-related costs. This clarifies that the same rules that apply for children with an IEP, an individualized education plan, that the same procedures and notifications are required for those children who are pre-kindergarten who have an individualized family services plan, or an IFSP as it's sometimes referred to. Madam Chair, members, Section 13 requires the State Interagency Coordinating Council to submit certain recommendations to the governor within 30 days of the federal government's determination of the Part C annual report, and that Part C report has to do with the pre-kindergarten special education services. Section 14 clarifies that it's the Education Department that's responsible for offering certain training programs for deaf or hard of hearing, blind or visually impaired students. This, again, is due to that transfer of the resource centers, which happened a number of years ago, and simply clarifies the language about the roles. Madam Chair, Section 15 is the same, again clarifying it's the Department of Education performing those functions. Section 16 directs the commissioner to establish the advisory committees for each of the individual areas instead of an advisory committee for each resource center. Madam Chair, Section 17 directs the statewide hearing loss early education intervention coordinator to collaborate with the K-12 deaf and hard of hearing staff person at the department. I may have a mistake here in the summary. I think that person may be a staff specialist, not a coordinator. I'll double check that for you. Sections 18 and 19 have to do with the payment of special education. These are clarifying changes that should not alter the alter the current manner in which the payments are envisioned. Madam Chair, members, Section 20 has to do with the Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'll have Ms. Larson speak to Section 20 here.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, Section 20 reflects a bill that Representative Wills introduced and the House Education Innovation Policy Committee heard. These reflect a number of recommendations from the legislative auditor with respect to changes in the state special education system and structure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 21 is the appropriations that Ms. Johnson will speak to, and Section 22 is the last of the provisions related to the transfer of the resource center duties to the Department of Education. 125A63 Subdivision 1 was simply the transfer that happened a fair number of years ago of the resource duties to the Department of Education. Madam Chair, that's it for Article 5.
Any questions? So Section 6.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, Article 6 is the Facilities and Technology article. A couple things to point out here. The first of these is the Alternative Facilities Program. This is an aid levy shift. This is not a revenue change. Currently, the 25 or so largest school districts in the state can do deferred maintenance activities through the Alternative Facilities Revenue Program. There's also an aid component to that program. That aid component is being reduced by about $9 million annually, which is not quite half of that appropriation. The result's an aid levy shift. There's no change in the access to the revenue or the likely amount of revenue expected in the program. Section 2 is the second part of that change. In statute, the entitlement for those aids is actually specified, and this simply reduces that entitlement to conform to the change in Section 1, the $9 million reduction in the aid. Section 3 eliminates the requirement that a school district have its technology plan on file for the Department of Education for purposes of claiming E-rate revenue. Currently, the E-rate revenue goes through the clusters, and the department's removing the need for the technology plan to be filed with them. Sections 4 and 5 are from the West Metro Education Program bill that was heard the other day. These have to do with the transition language necessary in the K-12 formulas for a smooth transition. The conveyance, which was Section 1 of that bill, is not in this bill, but the language that defines how the funding formulas should be modified and how the pupil transportation is specified, these provisions are in the transition language, as is language regarding to the ability of students to continue to attend the schools once those schools are transitioned to the member districts where they are located. And finally, Madam Chair, in Article 6, Section 6 is the appropriations article that Ms. Johnson will speak to.
Questions? All right.
Madam Chair, members, Article 7 is the nutrition and accounting standards, always an interesting pairing. A couple of provisions that are in here, these are generally from 1591. The first of these has to do with the data that Ms. Johnson and I received from the Department of Education. In an attempt to streamline the process, the department asked if they could give us one less week before they sent us official information and would allow us more time to see that information ahead of time. We're hoping that this smooths the process for transferring data for the forecasts between the executive branch agencies and the legislative staff. Section 2 is part of House File 1591. This requires that if there's a bad marriage between a district and its cooperative and there's an administrative law judge involved, that the costs of the Office of Administrative Hearings would be split between the district and its cooperative unit. It's my understanding those fees are currently paid by the MDE out of its budget. Then there's a number of date changes in the next several sections. These are date changes that were coupled with article or with Section 1 of this article. The idea behind these provisions is to give the department more timely access for information from school districts so that the forecast preparation can be a little smoother. So dates are moving both directions. Generally speaking, the dates for school districts to submit certain data are being moved about 15 days forward, and dates for the department to respond to certain things are being moved back by a few days, by the same 15 days. The idea is to essentially make the information available at a slightly better time for purposes of when MDE prepares the forecast information. Section 4 is another of these date changes, pushes the date forward by 15 days from January 15th to February 1st for an annual report on school district special education litigation costs. Section 5, the same thing for a survey of districts. Section 6 pushes the date backwards for the emissions of certain aid payments, again trying to get information to the department from districts sooner for purposes of calculating the forecast. Section 7 is a provision that this committee heard that extends for 2 more years the ability of school districts to transfer money among accounts and funds. The requirements are the same as for the last 2 years that this provision was in place. The transfer cannot affect a school district's aid or levy. Additionally, transfers are not allowed out of the Community Service Fund or the Food Service Fund. However, transfers within the Community Service Fund, as we heard a couple of bills on from, for example, school readiness to ECFE or the other way, would be allowed under this provision. And Section 8, Madam Chair, is the appropriations section for this article.
Article 9.
Madam Chair, Article 8 is an appropriations that Ms. Johnson will speak to, and Article 9, Ms. Larson will speak to the early childhood education provisions.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, as Mr. Strom mentioned, Article 9 contains the early childhood education provisions. Section 1 allows a Minnesota school district to inform the family of a child who has a Minnesota postal address of the availability of the state's developmental screening program. There are a number of provisions in this article related to this particular proposal. Section 2 authorizes the Commissioner of Education to renegotiate K-12 tuition reciprocity provisions with other states in order to allow students to enroll in kindergarten, before kindergarten, for early childhood special education services. Section 3 allows a child from another state whose family resides in a home with a Minnesota postal address to enroll in school before kindergarten. Section 4 allows the district to offer a coordinated early learning program to provide early childhood family education and school readiness services, as well as other early learning programs that serve parents and children. It includes in a district's early learning program revenue both its early childhood family education revenue and its school readiness program revenue, and any other revenues that are set aside for early learning activities. It requires a district that offers a coordinated early learning program to place all revenue just described in an early learning program reserve account that is established in the Community Service Fund. Section 5 on ECFE programs allows a district that provides a community education program to establish an early childhood family education program either as an individual program or as part of an early learning program. It requires a home visiting program to focus on reaching high needs children as early as is possible. Subdivision 5 requires a district operating an independent early childhood family education program to maintain a separate account within the Community Education Fund. Subdivision 9 directs a district advisory council to assist with the early childhood family education program and the early learning program. Section 6 on ECFE revenue describes the amount of the revenue, the uses of the revenue, which are restricted to early learning programs, including early childhood family education program. It requires the ECFE revenue to be maintained either in an early learning program reserved account or a separate account within the Community Service Fund. Section 7 addresses school readiness aid. It describes the use of the aid and provides for a reserve account. Madam Chair, Section 8 in this article on early learning scholarships has to be corrected in the bill summary, so please don't rely on the bill summary. Subdivision 1 establishes an early learning scholarships program in the Office of Early Learning. Subdivision 2 on family eligibility makes a parent under age 21 who is pursuing post-secondary training or education eligible for an early learning scholarship if there is a child who meets the eligibility age criteria and also the income eligibility requirements. Paragraph D says that beginning September 1, 2015, when state funds are available, any child under age 5 who currently receives an early learning scholarship under the Federal Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant becomes eligible for the state's early learning scholarship once the federal grant ends. Paragraph G of that section makes a child from an adjoining state who is assigned a Minnesota address by the U.S. Postal Service, who has received developmental screening and intends to enroll in a Minnesota school district, and whose family meets the eligibility criteria, also eligible for an early learning scholarship. Subdivision 3 requires the director of the Office of Early Learning to establish application procedures. Paragraph B allows the director to prioritize applications for early learning scholarship based upon listed criteria. Paragraph C, beginning in the fiscal year 2016, it requires the director to establish a target scholarship amount that is not to exceed the statewide general education revenue per pupil in adjusted average daily membership. Paragraph D, beginning July 1, 2016, it allows a licensed child care center or family child care provider to use the registration process to enroll scholarship recipients. It allows scholarships that are awarded to be paid to a provider designated by the grant recipient and also to be transferred to another provider at the recipient's request. Paragraph G strikes language that allows the school district or Head Start program in fiscal year 2017 and later to apply to the commissioner for a direct payment of state aid for scholarship recipients, and for fiscal years 2016 and later, it limits the amount, the total amount of funding allocated for program under paragraph D to the amount directly awarded in fiscal year 2015. Subdivision 4 states that to be eligible to accept an early learning scholarship beginning July 1, 2020, a program, among other things, must be a program that the director determines is eligible based on either an evidence-based program evaluation or a program review. Paragraph C of that subdivision declares a provider ineligible to participate in the Early Learning Scholarship Program if the provider has been disqualified for the reasons listed, for example, wrongfully obtaining child care assistance, or has been convicted in the last 7 years of an activity indicating a lack of business integrity. Subdivision 4A requires a program provider to maintain and make available upon request attendance records and records of charges and payments for participating children. Subdivision 6 on the use of funds requires scholarships to be used to supplement and not supplant federal funding, and requires also that scholarships be used in a program that the child attends consistently. Section 9 authorizes a school board that participates in a K-12 tuition reciprocity agreement to enroll and provide special instruction services to a child from an adjoining state who meets certain criteria. Section 10 contains the appropriations as Ms. Johnson will review. And that, Madam Chair, is Article 9.
Article 10, again, is the appropriation, so Article 11.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 11 is the self-sufficiency and lifelong learning article. There's a couple of changes to the adult basic education program made here. On Section 1 on line 171.28 of the bill, the growth factor for the adult basic education program, which is currently at 3% per year, is set to 0.5% per year. And then the next two sections, Madam Chair, authorize a community-based provider of adult basic education services that's otherwise approved by the commissioner that does not have district characteristics to receive essentially the average amount that the districts receive for each of those characteristics. So in Section 2, basic population aid, which is one of four parts of the early childhood or of the adult basic education formula, would be provided to community-based providers without district characteristics at $1.73 times the number of program participants at that site. And then in Section 3, both the revenue for those that are English language speakers and for adults who meet a certain category of not having a diploma, the average amount paid per participant in the programs with district characteristics would be used for the community-based provider that does not have district characteristics. Section 4 of the article is the appropriations, Madam Chair.
And Article 12.
Madam Chair, members, Article 12 is the state agency article. Most of the provisions in here Ms. Johnson will talk about, including the way some of the special revenue fund amounts are going to work. Section 1 is Representative Quam's School Crisis Response Team bill that was heard in this committee a few days ago. Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 all have to do with the transfer between special revenue funds and the general fund, and Ms. Johnson will speak to those as she works through the spreadsheet for you of the agency budgets. Sections 9 is the appropriation for the Department of Education. Then there are separate appropriations for the Board of Teaching in Section 10, the Board of School Administrators in Section 11, the Faribault Academies, the Minnesota State Academies in Faribault in Section 12, and for the Perpich Center in Section 13.
All right.
And Madam Chair, the last article of the bill often accompanies this bill. It's the forecast adjustments for fiscal year 2015. The process used in the education area is that the formulas to the best of the committee's ability are to be funded at the level the formula suggests. In the following year, if any of the formulas were short, those amounts are filled by excesses in other areas. If any amounts were large, those amounts are reduced. So you'll see some appropriations going down and others going up. These adjustments are essentially of no cost to this committee as they're a part of the budget base per the agreement about how fully funded forecast programs are to be tracked.
All right. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, could we go back to Article 6 with the alternative facilities aid and how that's a shift and not a loss of $9 million?
And Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, there's a couple places in the bill where there's shifting between aid and levy. On the spreadsheet you have in front of you, the district-by-district run, the revenue amounts stay the same, but the aid and levy mix changes. So a couple of places where this occur are the student achievement levy, the local optional revenue, and this is a third place on the alternative facilities levy. Currently, the levy, I don't have the figures right in front of me, the levy is about $150 or $160 million a year, I believe, and there's about $20 million of aid in that program. Distributed to some of the school districts that were eligible for aid when the aid was created in the mid-90s. Their aid is essentially being reduced by about half for that program. So those districts will see a levy increase. They're still eligible to levy for the amount of their deferred maintenance, but if instead of receiving aid for a portion of it, that portion will go to the local levy.
Madam Chair, then were we allowed to spend that $9 million then somewhere else?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, when Ms. Johnson gets to the fiscal spreadsheets, you'll see an aid amount and a levy amount. Essentially, what's offsetting each other here to a degree is the student achievement levy is spending $20 million of state aid and reducing levy by about that amount. And then some of these other programs will be going the other direction like this change. So you'll see when Ms. Johnson gets to the fiscal worksheet where the overall balance is on those, on the aids and the levies. But this committee's aid target is still the same target that it had when the targets were assigned.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Johnson, let's turn to the spreadsheet.
All right. Madam Chair and members, in the education finance world, we have the luxury of two spreadsheets, not just one, two. We have a state aid or appropriation spreadsheet, and that's the one I'll speak to first. It's the legal size and landscape form, and we also have the property tax levies, and I'll speak to that one second.
We don't have
one. You don't have one? Oh. Yeah, the property tax sheets came late, so Simon will get them run off for us. So
I'll speak to the appropriation first.
Okay, so we'll talk about the appropriation spreadsheet first.
All right. Madam Chair and members, the appropriations tracking spreadsheet here, I want to give you a brief overview of how it's laid out so that you can better understand what you're looking at because it's quite detailed. The columns from left to right represent the fiscal years that we are going to be tracking. So you see in column A, the February forecast is for 14 and 15. That's the current biennium which we are in. The next three columns are the forecast base, and that's for fiscal 16 and 17. And these are the years for which you're doing your setting the budget for the upcoming biennium. Columns E through F are the tails of the February forecast. Column H, I'll speak to when I get to areas that are impacted by that section. There's some cancellations, and I'll go through those as we come to them. Columns I through L are the most important columns on the spreadsheet as we go throughout the spreadsheet. The most important of all, though, is the column L. So you'll see in I, fiscal 16, J, fiscal 17, K is the total, and then L is the comparison to the February forecast base. Sometimes we compare to the previous biennium, sometimes we compare to base, but for the purposes of our budgeting in this committee, we will be comparing to forecast base. So if you follow column L all the way through to the end of the spreadsheet, you will get to the House target, which is $156.8 million. Before I get into that, though, I just want to mention columns M through P are the tails target that the House is recommending. We're not directly budgeting for these years, but to the extent that we're changing formulas or increasing spending in areas, we want to be able to see how that impacts next biennium spending. And then the columns, as you go through the pages of the spreadsheet.
Ms. Johnson, I'm sorry, could you just suspend for a second? Representative Crecia?
Thank you. Just one quick question. So and I think I know this, but just so I get it right, L, what's the spreadsheet formula for that? Is that column D from column K?
Yeah, it compares column K to column D. Yep. D.
So column L will be the difference.
Is the difference.
Thank you.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, as you go through the spreadsheet, it's laid out in the format very closely tied to the way that our omnibus finance bill is put together. So the first article is the general education article, where the large chunk of the spending is. And article 2 is education excellence and so forth. So that kind of gives you an understanding of the way the spreadsheet is laid out. As you can imagine, with the when we talk about education funding, the largest portion comes from the general education. In fact, on line 45, you'll see that this portion, the first article alone, accounts for over 80% of the state aid that we provide to school districts. So it's a significant portion, and the House proposal puts a significant portion of its funding recommendation in this section as well. If you take a look at lines 5, 6, and 7, you can see that the House is proposing a formula increase of $33 per pupil in fiscal 16 and $34 in fiscal 17. And that's about a little more than a 0.5% increase. And as we move down, then you can see how that correlates to spending figures. So the formula increase, and as Mr. Strom spoke to, the way the formula increase has now been linked, but is the compensatory on the dollars of this increase are distributed on a per pupil basis as opposed to on a concentration basis. So as you move across the spreadsheet there, I do want to point out at this time then that for all of the numbers that you're looking at on the spreadsheet, you'll want to add three zeros. So for example, for the formula increase, it looks like it says 31,287. It should be actually 31,287. And just to give you a context for that, above that, the number right above it is 6,512 and not 6 million. So pretty significant numbers here. But you can see that for the formula increase that's proposed, it would be a $31 million in 16 and a $66 million increase in 17 for a total of $97.6 million for the biennium. As Mr. Strom spoke to, there's also two pieces on extended time increases. There's a component for districts that would increase the amount of funding for that by $146 per pupil unit. There's also an extended time portion for charter.
Oh, sorry. No, it's okay. Representative Murphy.
But the $97 million on the formula increase, then you said that turns into $33 per student?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, it's $33 per year in fiscal 16, and it would be actually 67 in the second year, but it's $34 increase over the previous year. That makes sense? All right.
Ms. Johnson.
All right. Madam Chair and members, as I was saying, the extended time formula, there's also a component that is distributed to charter schools, and that's at 25% of the state average amount for extended time, and that is approximately $2 million for each of those extended time components. Line 18 is the equity revenue changes. This was a bill, I believe, that was brought forward by Representative Lucerno for all districts to currently, metro districts are the only districts that receive a 25% equity bump. Now, all districts, non-metro districts and metro districts, will receive that 25% bump, and that is at a cost of $2.4 million, and that begins in fiscal 17. On line 19, you'll see the enhanced local optional revenue, and that's Representative Anzell's bill that would provide enhanced equalization aid for districts that have a large proportion of seasonal rec property. It provides a direct aid offset, so the aid increases by the amount that the levy decreases. On line 20, you'll see the enhanced transportation sparsity. This is Representative Purcell's bill. It provides some additional assistance for districts that are in very sparse areas, and that has a cost of over the biennium of $2.8 million. On line 21 was Representative Loon's bill to repeal the student achievement levy and restore that aid offset. So you'll see correspondingly, and when we look at the property tax levy spreadsheet, the $20 million that levy decrease. And basically how this works is that currently when we put this in place, the districts were instructed to provide or to levy an amount equal to $20 million statewide, and that the same aid, the general education aid amount, was decreased by the same amount. So, but it was just a very small piece of the general education overall.
The new spreadsheets are available.
On lines 30 and 31, these are items, non-public pupil aid and transportation aid. These items are linked to formula increases, and to the extent that the formula is increasing, these formulas go up as well, so there's a revenue bump for those. And that it provides textbooks, other transportation types of services to these non-public schools. On line 33, you'll see the compensatory pilot grants. This is for a couple of districts that were looking at different ways of distributing or allocating compensatory revenue, and that would have a $10 million impact over the biennium. Any other questions on general ed area or any of those changes? All right. Madam Chair and members, on line 51, you'll see the achievement and integration. There's a savings of $6.1 million over the biennium, and this savings is due to the fact that the cap for revenue for our integration revenue per pupil is capped at $350 per pupil, and so the aid is provided at 70%. Up to $350 at 70% aid, 30% levy. Now, the districts that will be able to do a corresponding, because at that cap, they'd be able to levy for the difference that is being saved on the aid portion. And now that will also have a corresponding line on the property tax tracking spreadsheet. On line 53, you'll see the Success for the Future. That's a Indian Education Grant, current existing program that is increasing $750,000 per year in addition that the House is recommending. On line 55, this is the first of a number of items that will be shifting between the general fund and a special revenue fund that's being established, and I'll talk about that at length, but this program is being taken off of being funded through the general fund and will be funded through a special revenue fund. Line 58, this was statewide testing. When the number of assessments were put in place in 2013, the House had a legislative intent of providing kind of startup funding for the new suite of assessments and anticipated that they would scale back the funding for 16 and 17, but there was a mistake made in the rider in the bill, and so that there was no authority to scale back to that amount, but both the House and Senate tracking sheets reflected the lower amount, and so we're tracking that as a savings. On line 59, as Ms. Larson spoke to, there's some changing in testing, and so the requirement for all students to take the ACT has been recommended to be scaled back, and also the Explore and Plan. So there's significant savings of about $15 million for the biennium. On line 16, there's ACT reimbursements. This is because the ACT is now optional. They do want to provide some funding for students that are eligible for free or reduced lunch to be able to take the ACT. So this would provide reimbursement to the districts for providing for making the students eligible for the ACT test if they qualify. On the next page, on line 63, you'll see there's about a $9 million increase for the concurrent enrollment program. This is bumped up $3 million in 16 and $6 million in 17. On line 69, the Minnesota Reading Corps program is also receiving a recommendation for an increase of $3 million per year. On lines 67 and or 76 and 77, there's a program called Starbase STEM program. This was a program that was funded in the 2013 session. If you take a look at now on line or column H, you'll see that the House is recommending that because we verified that there was funding that has not been expended from this account for this program, they were recommending canceling the appropriation in fiscal 15 and reappropriating it in the following biennium. And so that you can see that on line 76 and 77. And then you can also see that for Starbase, that the appropriation, there is a $1 million savings from not having to make the appropriation for 16 and 17. And the amount for Starbase would continue at its existing level starting in fiscal 18 and 19. Lines 79 and 80 are both items that have existing balances that have not been expended, and the House is recommending repurposing those funds, and so there are cancellations for both of those items of $200,000 for the site-based decision-making grants and for the IT certificates. And there's a corresponding calculation further down in the spreadsheet that will further reflect how this works. On line 82, you'll see House is recommending a discontinuing funding for the civics education grants for a savings of $250,000 annually. On line 94,
there's line 81.
What did I?
The Principal's Academy.
Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped. On line 81, Madam Chair and members, is the Principal's Academy, and that is recommended to be funded at $250,000 per year for a total of $500,000 for the biennium.
Representative Murphy.
Could we go back to line 61? QCOMP, does that mean that no new school can get on QCOMP, or is there money in current base that allows new schools to come on to QCOMP?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, there is a cap on spending or on the appropriation of about $75 million, and at this point that cap has been reached and there is no additional funding at this point set aside for that specific purpose.
So, Madam Chair, there will be no new QCOMP schools approved in the next biennium?
Well, Representative Murphy, if by meaning approved, is there additional QCOMP money provided in this budget? No, there is not.
Thank you.
All right. Madam Chair, Representative, on line 94, you'll see a one-time appropriation for FY16 that's recommended for seclusion and restraint. I believe that's for best practices or to be able to reduce the incidence of seclusion and restraint for our special ed students. On line 106, you'll see the ALT facilities aid. This you'll see for the biennium on column L, a $8.1 million decrease. And this is, as Mr. Strom referred to, the corresponding, the aid is being decreased by $9 million, 8.1 on an appropriations basis for the first year. But then the districts that are impacted by this will have the ability to levy for that difference. So that will show up on the property tax levy tracking sheet. There's no other change items on this page. So I'll turn to the next page. And then we get to family and early childhood programs. On line 141, the ECFB program has a statutorily provided link. So to the extent that the formula is increasing, the appropriation for the aid portion of ECFB is also increased by $467,000. School readiness aid has an increase that is being proposed at $5 million a year. For the first biennium, it's at 90% for the first year, so there's just a little bit less than $10 million, but the intent is for an addition of $5 million per year increase for school readiness. Line 143 is the early ed services for certain students in adjoining states. This was a bill we heard by Representative Backer for early ed services with adjoining states of South Dakota. There were a number of students that they wanted to be made eligible for early childhood special ed services, and so this facilitates that. There was, in the fiscal note, there was that was stated that there was eligibility for a number of students to be qualified for the early learning scholarships, but that we determined that that's not guaranteed, and so that portion of the fiscal note was removed, and we just have the balance of what the cost that the department estimated. On line 148, at the early learning scholarship, Representative Precia's bill, there's an increase of $30 million over the biennium. It's scaled up, a $10 million increase in fiscal 16 and $20 million in fiscal 17.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've reviewed the language in the bill regarding the early learning scholarship new program, I guess, is kind of the way it's...
No, it's really more a continuation of the program with a few tweaks.
Okay. If I'm understanding it, is one of those tweaks removing the requirement that scholarship, that providers be 3 or 4 star rated, that there's an incentive, but they could now be used with any provider in the state?
Representative Dabney, no, but the requirement that they have to be 3 or 4 star rated is pushed out by 4 years. So right now it's to be effective in 16. We push that out to the year 2020, so 4 years from now.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, on the next line is 149, the statewide early childhood rating system. This is recommended to be funded at $1.2 million for 16 and $2.3 million for 17, for a total of $3.5 million for the biennium. This is sometimes referred to as the parent aware rating system, and this money will be in the form of a pass-through to the Department of DHS for funding for this particular program. On line 150, the parent-child home program, this was also Representative Loon's initiative or a grant program to increase grant-making for this parent-child home program of $100,000 per year.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had another question. I'm sorry to go back to the early learning scholarships. Then is Pathway 2 eliminated?
No, Pathway 2 is not eliminated, but the Pathway 2 dollars would be capped at the fiscal year 15 level.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, line 164 is the adult basic education aid. In current law, the inflation per year is 3%, and that is recommended to be scaled back to 0.5% for a savings of $3.4 million for the biennium. On the next page, this committee has jurisdiction over 3 state agencies, the Department of Education, Minnesota State Academies, and the Purpich Center for the Arts Education. And so I will talk you through each of these. And this is where it gets very complicated, or kind of deviates from our normal pattern. And so there may be questions, and I'm happy to answer those. On line 184, you can see the department operating adjustment. It's recommended a across-the-board decrease of about $3.6 million for the biennium. On line 185, the teacher licensing division, there are the next three, actually 185, 186, and 187, are all current initiatives that are funded through the Department of Education through general fund dollars, but are recommended to be funded instead through a special revenue fund. And so those dollars are removed from this section and will be present through appropriation through a special revenue fund, which I will talk about further down the spreadsheet. On line 188, Regional Centers of Excellence, the House is recommending a discontinuation of state funding for this particular program. There is federal dollars, but the recommendation of savings of $2 million from discontinuing state funding for that. The next line, line 189, is the School Safety Technical Assistance Center. This is a recommendation that is funded at $500 a year to eliminate the funding for the center, not to do away with the center, but just simply to not fund that particular area. On line 190, you'll see the math standards review, and that is that was pushed back to, I believe, 2020 or a later date, and the department identified that would be a savings of about $40,000 for that delay. Line 195 is in relation to Representative Seltzer's bill for the student exchange program reporting, and that requires the department to post data about incidents that occur when students are studying abroad, and that's about $23,000 per year, a total of $46,000 for the biennium. On line 209, the House is recommending, this was Daniel's bill for a technology initiative for the Minnesota State Academies, and that's just one-time funding for the 16-17 biennium of $1.2 million. And then on the next page, we get to deviate quite a bit again from our traditional ways that we think about general ed funding. So we've added a section called revenue and transfers to get at the pieces that have impacted the funding to the general fund. As I mentioned, the teacher licensing fees, I don't think I've mentioned this actually, but the teacher licensing fees currently are deposited into the general fund, and this proposal would deposit the funds instead into a special revenue fund. And so the appropriations for those activities would be made out of that special revenue fund. So to the extent that how it impacts the general fund, it's actually the $1.6 million per year is actually deposited into the general fund currently, and now it's being proposed to be transferred out of the general fund, so that is a loss to the general fund. On line 246, there's the Indian Teacher Preparation Grants. Again, that was identified as a program that would be funded not through a general fund but through special revenue, and so that is actually an increase because it's not coming from the general fund anymore. And on line 247, this is the sum of the cancellations that were identified for fiscal 15 at 1.4. That it totaled that, and so there's a corresponding increase in funding for fiscal 16 in revenues to the general fund because of those cancellations carrying forward into the next biennium. So you can see on line 248 what the total impact to the general fund is. And so there's a little bit more coming out of the general fund than that's going in, but that is offset or is reconciled in the section below. And I'll get to that in just a second. But I also wanted to note on lines 253 through 254, the newly established special revenue licensing special revenue fund, and this is where the licensing fees will now be deposited into the special revenue fund at $3.3 million annually, and also the board of administrators licensing fees will also be deposited here. On line 252, I should mention too, there is the governor had made a recommendation to be able to appropriate funds from the BCA or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension program for teacher licensing. When you apply, you have to go through a background check, and there's some fees that go unexpended, and this would give them this revenue fund authority to spend those dollars. So on lines 259 through 263, this is where we reconcile the overall impact to the general fund of all of the recommendations throughout the spreadsheet. On line 259, it's the top line appropriation dollar that we're used to seeing. And on line 261, we have to make an account for any loss or gain to the revenue fund or to the general fund due to changes. And in this case, there's a loss of $2.3 million. And so the net impact for the target actually ties out to the House's proposed target of $156.7. And then
Representative Murphy.
Back to the BCA and the teachers board. Does BCA get the authority to spend those funds, or does the board of teaching get to spend those funds from the background check?
Madam Chair, when a teacher, it's my understanding, when a teacher applies, they write out a check for all of the fees, and that all goes to the Department of Education. And then it's kind of like a holding place for it. And then when the background checks go forward, then those fees are transferred directly to the BCA. But there are cases, and this is the example of where candidates back out or, you know, don't follow through or aren't qualified, and then those fees remain because they are non-refundable fees. So they would stay there, but there wouldn't be, currently in statute, there's no authority to spend that revenue.
So Department of Education would be able to spend that then, or the Board of Teaching would get to spend that?
The special, yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, yes, the special revenue fund would have authority to spend those dollars for licensing purposes.
Thank you.
And then the final page will help hopefully clear up all the other, any other misunderstandings about how this is all going to operate. So because the pieces that have traditionally been funded through the Department of Education's agency appropriation are now being funded through the Special Revenue Fund. So we want to point out the direct appropriations that are being recommended through this process. So lines 279 is for the Board of Teaching Operations of $618,000 per year for a total of 1.2 for the biennium. And the same for the Teacher Licensure Division and also the Board of School Administrators. There are a couple of direct appropriations here as well to implement provisions that were outlined in the fiscal note for House File 2, which have to do with additional teacher licensing with student or candidates from other states and other particular costs identified for House File 2. On line 284, then you'll see the appropriation for the Indian Teacher Preparation Grants that will come out of the Special Revenue Fund going forward. And then on the revenue side for the Special Revenue Fund, you'll see the stream of the teacher licensing fees and administrator fees flowing into this fund to help pay for those board appropriations to do the teacher licensing activities. So that's about it. And there's a little bit of a balance. The revenues over the appropriations, and that's kind of intended on purpose because there may be years that there's fewer teacher licensing fees coming in, and you just want to make sure that there's adequate funding there.
Question? All right. Quickly, let's run through the levy sheet.
Yep.
And did everyone get the levy sheet that was handed out? Okay.
Madam Chair and members, the second spreadsheet is the property tax levies, and this is laid out in a similar fashion, right to left. The are the fiscal years, and the columns throughout the spreadsheet represent the different funds within school funding, so the general fund, the debt service fund, community ed, etc. So for the purposes of budgeting, or the what you'll be doing in committee here, if you look at column B, where it says fiscal 16, pay 15, these were levies that were certified this last fall and are currently being collected and will be available for the fiscal year that starts on July 1 of 2015 for fiscal 16. So the budget decisions that you're making currently would not impact this this current fiscal 16, but however, it will impact for column C, D, and E for fiscal 17. And so that's where we want to spend our time. And this will compare, again, we're comparing to base, so column E will compare to column C in terms of spending that is recommended versus the base. And on line 5, under the general education, you'll see the student achievement levy is being scaled back or removed, and that has a levy savings of $20.2 million. The location or local optional, the ANZEL bill that would provide aid in place of levy or to provide some additional levy equalization is about $460,000 in savings, in levy savings. However, on line 9, you'll see the equity. We talked about Representative Lucero's bill that for the equity
Baker,
bump.
Sorry,
Representative Baker.
To get confused.
For the equity.
That was for equity.
the 25% equity bump, and that has a levy impact of $6 million for fiscal 17. On line 23, you'll see the integration revenue component. So there are just a couple of districts that were impacted by the $350 per pupil cap. And so those districts that would normally be receiving aid are eligible to levy for those, the difference or that of that portion. And that's $4.6 million. On line 48, you'll see the out facilities. That's the other lever that is changing. The out facilities aid is decreasing by $9 million, and correspondingly, the out facilities levy is increasing by that amount. There are no other projected changes to the levy, so the bottom line perspective. Usually the Education Finance Committee works towards traditionally a zero levy target, and this one comes in at just over $1 million under that target. Any questions?
All right. Any questions from members? I know we went through it all fairly quickly. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I held my questions to the end.
All right.
And I have a couple of them, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Article 1, Section 2, whatever it is, front page. Extended support revenue.
Yes.
And I'm delighted to see some equity there. But why 25%? As opposed to equity with traditional districts for extended day. Is there a reason for that? And how do you justify the inequity between the charter public schools and the traditional public schools?
Thank you. Well, Representative Slocum, if I had had more money to work with, it would have been great to do it. But since charters have not been eligible for that, basically the concept here is to phase it in and to phase it, it would hope to phase it up. So we started with 25%.
Thank you. Let's see, Article 2, Section 31 and 32. On page... Molly, just keep turning. On page 12, grounds for discharge or demotion directs the school board in a first-class city school district to immediately discharge a teacher whose license has been revoked due to a conviction. Does that mean that if you're teaching in a greater Minnesota district that you can be, you can maintain and your license and continue working if you're convicted of child abuse or child sexual abuse? I mean, I know not.
Yeah,
but the wording there is a little cumbersome.
The short answer is no, and I'm going to let Ms. Larson explain why the drafting is the way it is.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum, the provision you cite is a clarification of language that was proposed by Representative Bennett and appeared in House File 2. And it indicates that when a teacher is convicted of child abuse, including child sexual abuse, and that individual's license has been revoked, then there it is immediate discharge. And that provision appears in several places. As you know, we have employment provisions related to teachers generally and also teachers in first-class city school districts. And even those sections are very similar in many respects, they exist independently of one another, so much of the language gets replicated at least twice. So in one case, if there's a reference to first-class city school districts, in all likelihood there's a parallel reference in an earlier section, 122A40, to teachers in districts generally, aside from those in first-class city school districts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And isn't she good? Yes, she is. My other question was in Section 32, discontinue teachers in the inverse order of their employment. Can you clarify what that means for me?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum, I am assuming you're referring to a provision that was actually originally part of House File 2. And the way that works is that the current law regarding unrequested leave of absence essentially is last hired, first let go. And so in the intervening period until the transition occurs, the language is permissive with respect to maintaining the current law up until the change becomes effective.
Thank you. I'm not done.
can I just go back to this
sure.
first one?
Chair, if I may, on section or Article 31, Section 2, about cities of the first class, that has nothing to do with school districts. Because, for example, my school district, District 11, has a population over 100,000, which would make it a city of first class if we were counting cities. But I don't understand how the correlation between cities of the first class and school districts. They're not two different things.
I'll let Mr. Strom explain that one.
Madam Chair, members, in statute, the statute makes a distinction between cities based on size. And a city of the first class is one that's over 100,000 students or was over that at the previous, 100,000 citizens or persons and or was grandfathered in from the census before. When we refer to it in the school district parlance, we refer to it as a school district located in the city of the first class. So the language is not that the school district meets that 100,000 student or 100,000 population, but rather that the district is within a city that meets the city definition of 100,000 population.
Thank you. Representative Slocum, reclaiming your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 3, Section 7D on page 20. It strikes language requiring 8th and 10th grade statewide math reading and writing assessments be predictive of a nationally normed assessment for career and college readiness. I just wanted to put in 2 cents. I sincerely hope that we have some mechanism early on, 8th grade, having given this test to my students, it's very nice to have kind of an academic snapshot. And then also to have the career assessment for kids so that they can start thinking about this, not that they need to choose a job for their life in eighth grade, because I don't believe that. But it gives them an area to kind of look at. It was one of the few assessments I thought was really worthwhile. Just 2 cents worth. But I'm not done. I have one more. Maybe two. Oh, Article 4. Section 10. And this section allows a charter school authorizer to terminate an existing charter school contract at the end of the current school year, notifying the school board, board of directors, blah, 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 based on federal school accountability measures if they've had 3 consecutive school years of bottom 10% performance. Now, in traditional districts, do we hold them to the same standard? And if not, why not?
Well, I'll just comment from, no, we don't. And if you'd like to propose an amendment, Representative Slocum, Thursday's your day.
Thursday might be my day. Right. I just would like to speak to equity between, these are both the district, traditional districts and the charters are public schools. They are deemed districts in and of themselves. And I think there should be equity across the board. So, yeah, probably there you'll see an amendment. Last question, Madam Chair. I spent the summer in a working group at MDE, and it was a really broad-based, wonderful group. And we studied teacher evaluation and the combining of QComp with, and I'm losing the initials, the alphabet soup that the other, yes. And we made recommendations, and there was a big ticket item, I know. But we put a lot of work in, and it was bipartisan, and it was a really good working group, I thought, a good cross-section of schools, districts from all over the state. It was a really, what's going to happen with that? Is there any funding for teacher evaluation? And there isn't for QCOMP, so any additional money. How are we going to evaluate teachers in any kind of an effective way if there's no money to do that?
Representative Locum, I'll answer you briefly. And higher ed needs this room, and we're over our time and into their time. So I apologize for members. And we will allow some time at the beginning of Wednesday's hearing to go through questions. And individually, if members want to seek me out and ask me or staff, please do that. But no, Representative Locum, there isn't new money in here. If we had had a little more, I probably would have done that. What we are doing, though, is, you know, with the 2% set aside that all districts have, making it clear that we expect that to be the priority for the funding for that money is for the teacher development and evaluation process before other things. And, on my personal list of things to look at for the coming year, QCOMP and teacher development and evaluation and staff development, all of that is sort of what I'd like to do. It's one of those things when you enter into this process, you realize that you need more time and there's other topics and things you'd like to tackle, and that's one I'd like to do next year.
I know, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I know it's a big ticket item, but I think it's critically important that if we're going to base whether teachers retain their employment or not on an evaluation, we got to fund how they do this and set up. It was a really productive working group, and I know they came in with some really good recommendations. Yeah. So I would love to work with you further on that.
Thank you. All right, members, I'm sorry. I know there was other questions, but again, we'll make sure that we allow some time. Wednesday's committee, again, is going to be devoted to some of our questions and then public testimony. I do anticipate we're going to go into the evening. We've got a room reserved, so I'd be prepared. In terms of amendments, which we will turn to on Thursday, I am extending the deadline for filing of amendments. So the deadline for filing amendments to the delete all will be 5 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. That's tomorrow. And if you wish to speak with me about amendments ideas, please come and find me. I'll try to spend as much time near my office or where Ms. Keynes can find me as possible. All right. With that, members, thank you. We are adjourned.